DW Deutsche Welle. Spectrum.
Hello and welcome to Spectrum on DW. Deep and dirty in the world of science and technology as ever. I'm Zulfikar Abani, and coming up, squaring ethical hacking, cybersecurity, and the law.
After arrests being made after hacks, then like a hacker community reacts by saying, well, we shouldn't report those things anymore because we're just going to get arrested, and that's bad for everybody.
Also on the program, the $1 million Bionic Man on show in London and pulsating woven vascular implants in Latvia. And if that doesn't get your blood racing, I don't know what will. That's right here on Spectrum. But first, the United Nations Office on Drugs and Crime is hosting a first-of-its-kind conference later this week to bring together heads of the UNODC, heads of the World Health Organization, the World Intellectual Property Organization, and customs organizations as part of efforts to combat the growing problem of fraudulent medicines. Among those are drugs against tuberculosis. Now, as we've been reporting, tuberculosis is one of the most deadly infectious diseases in the world, second only to HIV, the virus that causes AIDS. Despite our medical progress, about 9 million people still get infected with TB every year, a million of whom die. Deaths and infections are declining, but there's an urgent need for an updated vaccine. The current vaccine, Bacillus Calmette-Guerin, offers some immunity to babies, but almost none to adults, and trials on a new vaccine have also just failed. Now, add to this the findings from a new US study, also the largest of its kind, and the situation starts to sound a bit alarming. The study, published in the International Journal of Tuberculosis and Lung Disease, suggests that fake and poorly made antibiotics are being widely used to treat TB, but, and it's a big but, the researchers say that these substandard drugs are almost certainly making the disease more resistant to the real drugs, and that with a worldwide impact. I spoke to Dr. Roger Bate, a resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute and a lead author on the report.
Now, often what you're really seeing is what is a sublethal to the bacteria, sublethal dose of the active ingredient of the substance that would kill it. And so when you take a substandard medicine, you are probably killing some of the bacteria, but the more resistant strains are therefore able to proliferate. In a genetic sense, it's providing a lesson for the bacteria in how to survive against even good medicines.
And you found that this was taking place through your research team, that collected samples of commonly used drugs from 17 countries, including in Africa and Asia. Where exactly are we talking about, and what were you looking for? What sparked this off?
Well, the malaria community has been alerted to the problems of counterfeit and substandard anti-malarial drugs for at least a decade, and has started to institute programs to limit the likelihood of having fake and substandard medicines out there for treating malaria. The tuberculosis community is further behind, let's put it that way. So I have done, over the previous 5 years with my team, we've done a lot of sampling of anti-malarials. This was the first significant sampling we'd done of tuberculosis medicines. If you're a counterfeiter, you'll counterfeit anything that you could sell into the market. So it's not that this is that surprising. It is just, it's shocking in the sense that people are making money out of people's misfortune, and this is going to build resistance to the very few drugs we have that are effective against tuberculosis.
You mentioned counterfeiting there, but there has also been talk about there, of course, being just generally poor standards or perhaps problems arising through transit of the drugs. But how much of it is of a criminal aspect?
Yeah, it's a great question, and it is actually quite difficult to know. If you conduct a thorough investigation with the regulators, the legitimate drug industry, you can often find the people who are counterfeiting medicines. And they make millions of dollars in each country. The worldwide trade in counterfeit pharmaceuticals is well over $10 billion a year. Having said that, it's actually quite difficult without a massive investigation, which is expensive and embarrassing to countries and regulators often. It's actually quite difficult to assess whether a pill that fails quality control is just poorly produced by a legal manufacturer that has been degraded in transit or has been made by a criminal network.
And we're also talking about generics there, aren't we? Because there was the case last year, I think, or recently you wrote in a New York Times article, the Lipitor generics from India were found to have glass shards in it.
Yes, the problems are quite distinct. Obviously, the main legal definitions for counterfeiting require mens rea, as the legal community would call that, the guilty mind. So in other words, intent to deceive the patient in terms of what they're taking. What we find, though, in when you're out in the field is it's actually difficult to tell the difference. Sometimes you just don't know whether the manufacturer has made a mistake, whether they've willfully cut corners, or whether the drug is from a criminal enterprise. And what we've done with this study is it's a very much a preliminary study just to assess that there's a problem out there. To actually combat that problem requires a lot of effort from a lot of different people. You know, it requires from the high levels like the World Health Organization and the United Nations Office on Drugs and Crime, through to the regulators in each country, through to the pharmacists doing a better job to spot the fake packaging which comes through. It's all part of a educational process, and that was, I guess, our effort with this was to alert people that there's a problem with TB drugs.
And I suppose one thing that we tend to forget is that we think that TB is a poor person's disease. This also does affect, well, it affects the whole world, doesn't it, really? I mean, it's also of richer countries it's a problem. Why have governments been so slow to tackle this? Because I imagine, you know, the problem has been known, hasn't it?
Well, yes, there have been, you often get aid fatigue. So in other words, combating malaria and tuberculosis and HIV goes through cycles of people's effort, willingness to spend money to combat it, which isn't helpful from a medical, clinical standpoint. But people have known about the problems of counterfeit drugs, and to the credit of the international community, they're beginning to act against that. The biggest problem that I see is that it's very difficult to combat legal manufacturers that employ a lot of people in a country that often make good drugs but on occasions don't. And that's what I think we're finding for some of these TB drugs. They definitely weren't counterfeits, some of them. They were just poorly manufactured. And as you can imagine, and it's not just India, it could be China, it could be Brazil, it could be Germany, the United Kingdom, or America. Local companies employ a lot of people, and they generally do a good job. It's always embarrassing to the regulators and the companies when that happens. And that's the part of the problem is that I think is going to take a lot longer to deal with.
Dr. Roger Bate at the American Enterprise Institute there. And Roger Bate will be one of a couple hundred participants at the UNODC meeting on the 14th and 15th of February in Vienna. It's the biggest conference ever on the topic. And as Roger Bate told me, we might not hear a lot more than a whole load of people saying that they're taking the problem seriously. But that, he says, is often the first and most important step.
Digital Europe, bringing the continent's tech scene to your ears.
Well, you might think that all hackers are out to get into your laptop so that they can just steal your credit card data and perhaps also your money. But in fact, there are many hackers out there trying to improve online security to stop just that happening. The Dutch government has recently acknowledged the social merits of such ethical hackers, but not all companies and organisations agree with the government. A Dutch MP had to appear in court recently after he raised the warning over a data leak at a medical research centre. He was not the first to report a security breach, but still had to defend himself in front of a judge. Peter Teffer reports from The Hague, where a recent panel discussion at a cybersecurity conference looked at this very conundrum.
You haven't had a go at it, have you, sir? So, first of all, you, sir.
Flex Warren, I'm a security consultant. It strikes me that the focus is so much on the discussion of the hackers. The hackers very much well know what a white hat hacker and a black hat hacker is, and all the grey variants in between, 50 shades of grey, I think. The companies are now confronted, I guess, newly with responsible disclosure. And they don't have these processes. It's, I guess, that party that you really need to make comfortable with this process. Because the first thing, when you get a message that you don't want to hear necessarily, the first thing is a very human one. It's denial.
Responsible disclosure, ethical hacking, white hat hacking. There are already quite a few expressions for the phenomenon of those who test security capacities of computer systems. Ethical hackers recently gathered in The Hague for a conference. Buddy van Kampen, for example, found out last year that a public swimming pool that had a system for regulating the chloride levels was not well protected.
To report as that the official owner of the pool was an option. On the other way, we were doing things which were quite on the edge of legal or illegal. So it was very shady about the fact, is this a good way or a bad way? Is some policeman coming to knock on my door, yes or no?
Van Kampen did what others in similar situations have done as well. He called in a journalist. However, companies do not always respond well to media attention about a security leak. When Henk Krol, a member of the Dutch parliament, discovered last year that certain personal medical files could be easily accessed online, he approached the medical research center responsible for the website, but felt he wasn't taken seriously. So he contacted a local journalist. And in response, the research center reported the case to the police. If ethical hackers have to fear legal repercussions, this might dissuade them from reporting any leaks anymore, says software developer Floor Terra.
The hackers communicate amongst each other, and then they won't report any problems to you anymore, and the general trust in reporting problems will go down. I've seen that after arrests being made after hacks, and like a hacker community reacts by saying, well, we shouldn't report those things anymore because we're just going to get arrested, and that's bad for everybody.
The Dutch government has just published guidelines on what it calls responsible disclosure. If a company adopts these guidelines, it promises not to press charges against hackers if they investigate and report a problem according to certain rules. One such rule is that the leak shouldn't be made public until the company has had a chance to fix it. At the cybersecurity conference, Minister of Security and Justice Ivo Opstelte had this to say.
The guidelines must allow those on the outside to help maintain or boost an organization's information security levels. Under strict conditions, they can report holes, leaks, or other weak spots in systems without fear of repercussion. Of course, the Public Prosecution Service will still have the independent authority to prosecute criminal offenses.
To some people in the ethical hacking community, that last part stings. They feel that they've not been given enough protection against prosecution. But Wil van Gemert, who's responsible for the guideline, says some cases have to be referred to a court.
If there is a discussion about how far that you have been, I think that's the moment then to let an independent judge decide if the things that you are mentioned and the way that you act are in balance with the law. That's not up to us to decide.
And as long as you play by our rules, we make a clear promise in our responsible disclosure policy that we will not take legal action against you or file a report to the police.
That's Robin Schaal, who works for Marktplaats, a Dutch website with classified ads. Last year, the company adopted its own guidelines for ethical hacking. Already, Marktplaats has received some valuable tips.
A student here in the Netherlands found that through one of the links from our emails, we were not enforcing secure HTTP for a login, and so it was vulnerable to a man-in-the-middle attack. This was solved within 24 hours, and this person is now doing an internship at our company. So it turns out to be a great source for recruitment as well.
Dutch Minister Opstelten has said he will promote the guidelines and will ask other government organizations to adopt them. As for Member of Parliament Henk Krol, earlier this month the prosecutor demanded a fine of €1,500 for digital trespassing. The court will decide this Friday, February 15, whether to follow that advice. Peter Teffer, DW, The Hague.
And you're listening to Spectrum with me, Zulfikar Abani, on DW. Online, we're at dw.de/spectrum. And you can, of course, always follow us at DW_SciTech. And you might like to know that DW's 9th annual online activism contest has just started. So make sure you check out bobs.com. That's bobs.com, if you're in any doubt there. And start submitting your favourite blogs. You can also follow the contest on Twitter at DW_TheBobs. And of course, we'd be nothing if we weren't on every other thinkable social media platform, which means just Facebook, to be honest. And I sincerely hope that you're not one of the millions of Americans currently suffering from FB fatigue. But hey, we do also love Google+. But on that note, I was talking to our resident blogmeister, Sean Sinico, the other day, and he's saying that there's quite a move to get people away from social media and back into blogs. Now, if you can read German, head over to Johnny Heisler's Spreeblick blog. That's Spreeblick. 2013, das Web zurückerobern. Reclaim the web, says Johnny Heisler. But, of course, DW takes no responsibility for any such third-party content, so, of course, you're at your own risk there. A $1 million bionic man has just gone on show at London's Science Museum, replete with artificial organs like pancreas, kidneys, among other organs, and a functioning blood circulation system. One thing that's missing is living tissue, so he's not strictly bionic, but it's bionic enough for us here at Spectrum. And he goes by the name of Rex, which is short, of course, of the altogether more scientific robotic exoskeleton term. Now, we've seen a number of amazing developments in the past few years in prosthetic technology. You might remember that Claire Lomas became the first person to complete the London Marathon wearing an exoskeleton last year. Rex now is the next step and promises to challenge our preconceptions of human identity. At the unveiling of Rex in London was the German but Swiss-based social psychologist Dr. Bertolt Meyer, who was born without a lower left arm and has been using prosthetics all his life. He says there's been a surge in progress in the past 5 or 6 years.
We're seeing at the moment an explosion of innovation. I mean, if you just look, for example, at the artificial hands that are attached to our bionic body, these are off-the-shelf hand prostheses that you can buy on the market. However, these fully articulate hands that have built-in pressure sensors that with built-in chips try to understand the shape of the object that they're grasping, these hands, they didn't exist just 3.5 years ago. So they're so new. And before that, technology in hand prostheses was basically stalling. I mean, there was no change really for about 30 years. And suddenly we see this technology appearing on the market. And that's not only for hand prostheses, that's for many other bits that made its way into our bionic body, the foot and ankle system and the internal organs.
And that really is a break with this image that we have of bionics, of robotics in a sense. We have the sort of very sci-fi image many people do in their minds. But given that there's no living tissue in Rex, strictly speaking, we can't really talk about Rex as being a bionic man, can we? Or what's the
Correct.
Difference there?
No, you're right. You see, Rex consists of parts that were all designed to attach to a human body. And if you don't have a body in the first place, there is nothing much that these things can do. And therefore, Rex and his abilities is fairly limited. He can walk only very, very slowly. You can't really have a conversation with him. And his vision is very, very poor because the central bit, the human, is still missing. So what that means for the development of robotics, what we probably won't see is a sudden change in paradigm that will have humanoid robots suddenly walking around the streets. But I think what this project shows us that the change will be more gradual, that it will become normal to see humans wearing artificial robotic, if you will, body parts. And that will probably become something quite normal.
And then I suppose, in a way, is where you come into this, isn't it? Because you have a very personal interest in robotics, in bionics. You were born without a left hand. That's correct, isn't
That's correct. I was born without my lower left arm, and I am wearing an advanced hand prosthesis myself, so I have a very personal and emotional attachment to the subject of prosthesis and their development.
Can I just jump in there,
yeah.
if I may?
Yeah.
How has that affected your life? And given that you've now worked on this progression in the actual technology of what's so intimate to you, how has that changed in your life?
Well, for a very long time, I wore an arm prosthesis that I didn't like at all. It looked horrible, and it was very, very limited in what it could do. It was basically a hand that was fixed in one weird, awkward position. Like you still see on World War II veterans sometimes. At best, it's oozed 1970s technology. I hated that thing. And only when I came across the new development a few years ago, I thought, wow, that would be a real, real advancement of my quality of life. Not only because it would allow me to do more things in a better way, really the small things that make your life living, cooking, tying your shoelaces, driving a car, holding something in one hand while you're doing something with the other, all these things that we take for granted, but that really have a strong impact on your subjective quality of life. Not just that, also having a prosthesis that you feel comfortable with, also that looks in a very personal way aesthetically pleasing, gives you a better feeling of self-confidence, really. It makes you less aware of your limitations and more aware of what you can do, and therefore has a very positive psychological impact on the wearer.
And I suppose this really comes to the nub of what's happening at the moment in London. This is Rex is on show at the Science Museum, but there's also a television programme. Do you think that in a way people's perceptions will change? Or let's say this television programme, will it just remind people of, say, Gunther von Hagen's televised live autopsies? Is there going to be that sort of freakish element to it? Or do you think it really can help people to get inside people's heads to say, this is the score?
Yeah. Technology in terms of bionics and prosthesis can still have a bit of something eerie and awkward, definitely, because the body in its entirety, to be honest, it doesn't really look aesthetically pleasing. That's because all of these parts were never designed to work together. So you get something that's a bit of a patchwork, not as bad as Gunther von Hagen's autopsies, probably. But, you know, some parts of it may be a bit unnerving. But if you look at some of the parts individually, I'm thinking especially about the feet, the ankles, the hands, they in and themselves are beautiful pieces of technology that will definitely change the way we perceive disabled people. But I think this change, independently of this program, has already begun. Remember, at the last Paralympics, the runner Oscar Pistorius, who also ran at the regular Olympics, he has two artificial legs. Now, having artificial legs and having your legs amputated used to evoke a sense of pity. With him, suddenly people were debating whether these legs were giving him an unfair advantage. Now, isn't that quite a drastic change from prosthesis as signaling pity to prosthesis signaling potential superiority? That's quite a change, and we're already starting to witness that.
Dr. Berthold Meyer of Zurich University talking to me there about the Bionic Man, which he's helped co-develop with Rich Walker and others at Shadow Robot. Now, each year around 4 million Europeans die of cardiovascular diseases, and about half of all the people come from the European Union itself. That's according to statistics published by European Heart Network, an association of health NGOs across the continent. For instance, atherosclerosis is a condition where an artery wall is thickened and hardened by plaque, made up of fatty materials like cholesterol, which restrict the blood flow. The disease sometimes requires patients to undergo surgery to fix the affected blood vessel with a prosthesis. Now, a Latvian scientist has developed a unique method to create a blood vessel prosthesis which can even pulsate. Gunārs Gelzis in Riga has the details.
One of the rooms at a building in Riga, which used to be barracks for Russian soldiers more than 20 years ago, now reminds of a small textile factory. There's a monotone sound of a machine which occupies the central part of the room, and it continuously weaves a fabric. But this is not a textile factory, and it has nothing to do with the clothing industry. The machine at the lab of Riga Technical University does make something that people can wear, but only on the inside. That's 81-year-old Viktorija Kancevica, a professor at the university's Textile Technology and Design Institute. She explains that the sophisticated machine is a special loom which weaves prosthesis for arteries, including the aorta, the main artery. The prosthesis range from 25 to even 3 millimeters in diameter, but the length can differ widely from patient to patient.
We want to improve the blood vessel prostheses which are implanted during surgeries and are used to replace or repair blood vessels, be it an artery or the forked aorta. And without doubt, it's much more difficult to make a forked aorta.
Kancevica says that in order to make the two forked prostheses, the loom has been specially adapted and the weaving process is controlled by a computer. But that's not what makes the prosthesis so special. The artificial blood vessels are weaved from very fine synthetic non-toxic fibers, polyester and polyurethane or lycra. The lycra is a very elastic fiber which is usually used in tight-fitting clothes, but the polyester is made from synthesized polymers and it keeps its shape. And it's the criss-cross weave of the fibers which makes the difference, says Kancevica.
Our prosthesis is able to pulse both lengthwise and crosswise without changing its parameters and the diameter. But the knitted prosthesis, for instance, doesn't have such qualities. It's able to stretch lengthwise, but its diameter is getting smaller.
Kancevica explains that the blood vessel's ability to pulse is very important because it helps circulate the blood as the heart pumps it round the body. But if the prosthesis is hard, then the circulation of blood slows and the implant begins to build up with cholesterol, for instance. Though there are various other prostheses created, none of them has such pulsing abilities, says Kancevica. Up to now, the prostheses have only been tested on 9 dogs. They are not pets, of course, but beagles, specially bred for laboratory studies. They arrived from France and participated in the tests from the summer of 2011 to autumn last year.
The dogs were kept in a room and there was also a garden where they could roam during the warm weather in spring and summer. We nurtured them and monitored their activity carefully as time went by.
That's Aija Malniece, a veterinary surgeon. She participated in the research at the Latvia University of Agriculture in Jelgava, a city where the tests took place.
The main results of the tests show that the prostheses for aorta were not clogged with cells of new intima. They are the cells which create the innermost layer of an artery or vein. And it didn't happen during a year.
But Malniec says the research did produce good results. The study with the beagles is just the first step and more tests on animals still have to be carried out. That's an opinion shared by Dainis Krievinš, a professor of vascular surgery at Pauls Stradiņš Hospital in Riga.
There are rows of diseases and pathologies where it would probably be much easier for us to operate if we had such a prosthesis. And I think that such implants would be most suitable for small blood vessels. But I'm responsible for my patients, and as a doctor, I have to be sure that first, the prosthesis is safe for the patient to use, and second, it does function.
As with all new medical developments, Krievinš makes it clear that before the prosthesis can be approved and used on real patients, they still have to undergo clinical trials on humans. And only if the human trials are a success will the implants make it to market. Kancevica is confident that if the pulsing blood vessel prosthesis proves its value in the clinical trials, it will improve the quality of life for many patients. Jadars Jelzis, DW, Riga.
And that's just about all from Spectrum on DW for now. Don't forget, you can always keep up with our stuff at dw.de/science. And listen again or download the podcast, if you like, at dw.de/spectrum. Don't forget, thebobs.com. Till next time, I'm Zulfikar Abani, and our studio tech was Thomas Schmidt. Do join us again next time, if you like, when we hope to get inside Tourette's. Thanks for listening, and bye for now.